This is the Chuck O'Chelly Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
I'm here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. That's an equally simultaneously a corny and yet somehow cool line from the cult classic, They Live. Right? Starring Rowdy Roddy Piper. I know. Is that what today's show is about? Well, it wasn't what today's show was planned about. I had a plan, and moments before, as I was listening to the news break, quite honestly, it went away. So we'll see what we can scramble together, but I'm sure it'll be relevant and interesting. And worse comes to worse, you may have to put up with me for a full 3 hours. That's okay. That's okay. I had things in mind, you know, and it wasn't about Hollywood. It wasn't about They Live. Of course, the best part of that line I left out, right? I'm here to chew bubblegum and kick ass, and I'm all out of bubblegum. Like I said, corny and yet classic all at the same time. So I was going to speak with Celly Castillo today, who is the author of Powder Burns, okay, Cocaine Contras and the Drug War. And I did want to focus on the drug war, so I'm going to go with the story I was going to tell you in the first hour anyhow. What would that be? Well, a story that you would be familiar with if you're anywhere in the Western world, I think, but especially in this place we used to call America. Why? Because if you've been alive more than a decade, you've seen some wave of drugs hit your streets. You've seen some wave of drugs go in and destroy entire neighborhoods. You've seen communities decimated. You've seen it happen. You've seen the participation of Big Pharma in that most recently, of course, through the opioid crisis. That would be a wonderful political football for a lot of people. But, you know, it's well beyond a political football for those of us who have been impacted. And I got to say that I have met very few people who have not been impacted one way or another by the various waves of, like I said, the illicit drugs. Now, as a libertarian thinker, as somebody who believes in the supremacy of the individual's right to do as they please, to do what they will, okay? I know it sounds Aleister Crowley-ish, but bear with me. It is not necessarily like that. I just think that it's nobody's business what it is you want to put in your body. And quite frankly, the government being engaged in a war on substances that they have deemed on a schedule to be one way or another illicit, dangerous, excessive, beyond that which you should be allowed to consume, you know, for your own protection, as per usual. I find the whole thing ridiculous. So I'm one of these guys who says that drug prohibition is a ludicrous, ludicrous undertaking. It has done nothing but become a war on people, people that for one reason or another have reached into the illicit substances, have gone after things. Of course, it's all good if you have the well-taxed alcohol and tobacco, which, you know, kill plenty of people all the time. But is good business for the government. And even as we see the legalization of things like cannabis emerging throughout the country, and certainly in the past decade or so, I would say, it's been more progressively accessible and acceptable among, well, the majority of we the people. Cannabis, that is. And in some places, people have had controversial viewpoints about needle exchanges and a safe using spaces for individuals. You know, just this past year, New York City got itself a couple of places where you could use illicit substances with some safety protocols accessible to you. And there are people that think that that is absolutely horrendous, ridiculous, and leads to more and more use of these substances, which does destroy people. But here's the greater question. Is it the criminality which grows from criminalizing substances that creates the excessive criminality? Is that the thing that leads to the problems? I mean, there's been plenty of cheap dope on the streets. I mean, my whole life, one way or another. it got into the more polite parts of the country and started to stress out the suburbs and things like this. And quite frankly, once again, there is a bit of racism built into it. There always is. I mean, this is the reason why marijuana is called marijuana. It's cannabis. Get it straight. And it's a plant. It's a plant. So, you know, the plant they banned, there's a whole history behind that. Am I going to go through that with you? No, I'm assuming that since you're listening to me, you're already aware of the real history of why cannabis is the way it is. But back to the shooting zones or shooting galleries, legalized ones, because, oh, by the way, that's what we used to call them in the old days, buildings where you could go and nobody cared what was going on inside of them. And so IV drug users would shoot up in them. We called them shooting galleries commonly. And there were nightmarish places. I mean, people have heard of crack houses too. Of course, this is commonplace in the nomenclature at this point. You know, you can name certain places, certain things. Yes, indeed. The evolution of this has gone on for quite some time and was going on long before I got here. Like I said, I was only born in the 70s, early 70s. So I got to a certain point where, quite frankly, I lived in the invisible part of America. The invisible part of America is that part of America where a lot of people don't want to admit that it exists, that the people exist there, that they matter, that they count. Only statistically, only pointing to violence in certain areas and things like this, that is how they dismiss what really goes on in the invisible parts of America, the parts of America that, oh, nobody really wants to face. So I'm going to get into my personal history. I mean, I'm going to go through all of this and philosophically, intellectually, try and combine all of this stuff about the drug war into the first half of this hour. In the second half of the hour, I'm just going to tell you a personal story. And it's going to explain maybe why I take the drug war so personally, a little bit. But anyway, there's your preview. Back to this discussion. And like I said, the safe use zones and all this kind of stuff. And of course, there is debates that go on regarding, you know, is there a need to constantly bust low-level drug dealers because they're not really the problem and things like this. And people talk about it from a law enforcement point of view, from a punitive point of view, and society in general, despite their own hypocrisies regarding the use of various substances. You know, it doesn't matter that the three drink lunch guy would sit there and commonly put down the one joint guy over lunch. It's just a thing, you know, dirty hippies smoke that stuff, you know, drug addicts and things like this, even if people aren't actually literally addicted to a substance. Okay. A lot of judgment, a lot of things where people are not exposed, but in the past couple of years, people have had no choice but to engage with members of their family, members of their community, one way or another. Because as I said, the transition, especially in the post 9/11 reality, of things like opioids, and that does include heroin, that does include all of the pills, you name them, whether they're Lortabs, Percocets, so on and so forth. All of those things creeped into every part of America. People talked about how terrible it decimated Appalachia, all of that. And these are all true stories, yes, indeed. Is there a root to this cause? Or is there a cause to this root that, again, people will ignore? Because, as per usual, like I said, in invisible America, some things are even buried under the ground that no one wants to unearth. I mean, they're willing to stick their head in the sand, but they don't really want to get into the dirt. Anyhow, back to it. Like I said, the evolution's been interesting. And beginning with the time when, oh, suddenly, there was a great deal of dope on the streets in neighborhoods that, again, could be scorned, could be looked at from afar by the majority of America and looked down upon in a literal sense, because look at these junkies. Look at how they destroy their neighborhood. I mean, popular culture reference one more time. In the movie The Godfather, right? even the gangsters sat around debating about whether they would sell heroin, whether they would go into that business. A lot of money to be made in those powders, Pop. Yeah. Sonny Corleone told that to Vito, but later on in a bigger meeting where they were considering it, it's okay, we can sell it in certain neighborhoods, but not near schools and not to children. Yeah. Some of those moral judgments are actually true to life, but pay no attention to the difference between the Hollywood screen and the reality, because they too often meet together. And the amazing thing, of course, after that time period, which is depicted in that movie, and even before that time period, there was plenty of heroin, plenty of dope going around. But again, it was contained. It was the cities, right? It was the artsy people. It was, well, just they, them, those people. It's okay. But once the big pharmaceutical companies, again, packaged opium, because they've done this repeatedly, by the way. Again, look to your history. You find that, sure, heroin or an opiate of some type was in everything from menstrual cramp elixir, okay, to cough medicine, going way back in America's history. It just kept getting repackaged. I mean, we all know about cocaine being in Coca-Cola, and don't worry, we'll get to cocaine shortly too. Because it is a slightly different element in this mix, but equally baked in, brothers and sisters. The thing is that they kept repackaging it. Morphine, you know, stuff like that. And opium in and of itself, right? Yeah, sold as remedies, packaged, repackaged. Nobody ever said, hey, look, you can get addicted to this stuff, so on and so forth. Okay. I even remember during literary debates about Sherlock Holmes, when I was in high school, being actually scolded a bit for talking about this concept that within the subtext, maybe Holmes was an opium addict or user, even though he's a fictional character. Yeah, they didn't want me talking about that in school. I mean, pay no attention to the fact that some of the students in the place where I went to school were shooting up in the bathroom. I mean, you know, let's not look at the reality around us or anything. But all right. Don't say Sherlock Holmes was a dope addict. I got you. But the amazing thing is that, like I said, it had gone on for a while, and it was a fair trade for the gangsters. It was a fair trade for a lot of the criminals, one way or another. A lot of the people who beg to try and survive outside of the system a little bit. The outlaws, this and that. Certainly, there are various elements that have gotten involved in various substances, and some of them are better organized than others. I mean, in America, once again, we could go through the history of the outlaw biker gangs, and I mean, almost everybody knows that they used speed or crystal meth or, you know, whatever. I mean, stay awake on a long ride. Cocaine, too. Don't worry, cocaine gets everywhere, and we'll get there. Because I haven't even gotten into just the time I've been alive yet, really. American history is riddled with drugs. And a lot of it, like I said, was produced by these major entities one way or another, the corporatist entities, some of them surviving to this day. Matter of fact, if you look back, at the methadone clinics and stuff like that, that were funded by the Rockefellers and all that good stuff. Look, these philanthropists, these industrialists, they were always involved with the drugs. And I know there's a longer history on the rest of the map outside of this place we call America, certainly, that you can turn to and find the different drug wars and find the different uses, actually the weaponization of it by the British crown in order to let their companies, their various corporate ventures, make money and also strategically hinder populations and their ability to thrive by making sure that there was plenty of cheap dope available for them. I mean, that goes back centuries. It's just, anyway, back to America. So the Rockefellers, yeah, they bring about the methadone clinics. And morphine, funny thing about morphine, is that heroin was actually first processed and developed by your friends at Bayer Aspirin to get people off of morphine. Check it out. It's an interesting story for sure. And then, you know, we can jump ahead in the opiate story quite a bit, if you like, and get into the 1960s. And this time in which America was involved in the Vietnam War. And that was part of what I was going to talk to Sully about, because he was a veteran of the Vietnam War. And don't worry, we're going to bring him on the show again soon. And we'll cover this, I assure you. But just from my mouth to your ear, the Vietnam War starts to go on. And there's this area, not really in the war zone, but just outside of it, where plenty of it could be harvested. Plenty of it was being harvested and being fed through, you know, places like France and through the Marseille and what some people call the French mafia, but it's organized crime. It's not really mafia. I hate the use of the word mafia, by the way, for a lot of these groups that are not mafia. Indeed, the Mexican mafia is closer to the Italian mafia than most of the other things that people call mafia. Am I taking offense because of my own ethnic heritage? Maybe. But thing is, it just get down to the reality. I mean, there's a lot of things they call mafia, and they're not necessarily mafia. But organized criminals in France, they definitely had a good heroin trade going and were more than happy to put it into all sorts of spots in Europe. I have no idea how this played out in Oceania. And of course, in Asia, well, they've had their own issues with something that grows over there readily. So, okay, back to the American problem. So the Vietnam War, this thing begins while Kennedy is in office. So pre-1963, because at the end of 1963, Kennedy no longer has part of his head. And they reversed his policy where we would not have had that atrocity for a decade that we do now refer to as the Vietnam War. But if you ask the Vietnamese, they'll tell you it was the American War of Aggression. And not arguing with either side of that. I do argue with the damage it did to our country. I do argue with the damage it did to our society. I do argue with the damage it did to, guess what, the male role models that might have been available to me as a child if, well, anyway, like I said, I'm going to save the personal story for the next half hour. So anyway, the Golden Triangle, this is an area just around Vietnam, perfectly accessible. And you might know the American gangster story, right? There was an interesting guy who took over for Bumpy Johnson there in heroin, trafficking, distributing it throughout a place called Harlem in New York, which was plenty lucrative enough for any one-man gang, for any organization to thrive upon. Of course, left out of that movie is truthfully, it's kind of represented there, but not fully represented there is Fat Tony Salerno's role in all that and running part of Harlem. But all right. Doesn't matter. Hollywood is not necessarily reality until reality decides to shift and make itself into Hollywood, which happens all the time. I digress. So in the 1970s and the 60s, the progression, the ease of access to all of that cheap dope coming out of that area near the Vietnam conflict, no matter how you want to couch it, disastrous war and all of that, highly profitable for the underworld. And again, I might have a personal story about that in the next half hour. But this is just simple fact. I mean, it's accessible to anybody who wants to check it out. This is dope was on the streets, cheap, readily available, and so much of it, it couldn't be sold fast enough. Now, cocaine was also available, but, you know, limited quantities. Not really high, not until we get into, well, the CIA needed a new revenue stream, didn't they? Because make no mistake, if you check out things like the Phoenix Program, you check out the works of Doug Valentine, I mean, he can explain it for you in a book or two. Not an issue. Exactly how this might have worked. And I know there's many other people who have done it too, but anyway, it's accessible. It's out there. Maybe we'll bring Doug Valentine on the show soon. That's a good idea. So that went on until the end of the Vietnam conflict, which was, 1976. So now the cheap dope stream is gone. What are they going to do? Well, they had to continue on the business, and then we got to get into cocaine. So we're going to get there in the next half hour. Maybe I'll drag out that personal story to the hour afterwards. We'll see. We'll see how this flows, because there is a lot to be told here. And I think the progression, the history, the reality, and we're going to take it all the way up to today. If I get a chance, unless I get random appearances by a friend or two here on the show, I'm just going to sit here and tell you a story. Story time on the Chuck Ocelli Show. How about that? I think that might not be so bad. Anyway, it's all about dope. Every war is definitely a drug war, and the drug war that they tell us about, maybe not quite as advertised, although it does have an effect. And so will this break. Stick around. We'll be back.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp.
I can probably hit the green from here.
Probably.
Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Using meth taught me everything about freedom, only not like you think. It taught me how easy it is to lose your freedom. If you think meth is taking control of you, ask for help. You have the power to be truly free. I know. I'm Jan, and I'm free from meth.
If you or someone you know is struggling with meth, call 1-800-662-HELP for 24-hour free and confidential treatment referral. Learn more at samhsa.gov/meth.
Suck it up.
It's not a big deal.
Snap out of
it. Just get over it.
We've all heard it. But if you're experiencing extreme stress, it's not just in your head. It can affect your entire body, because toxic stress can hurt us physically without us even knowing it. If you've lost a job, worry about your next meal, or have trouble making it through the day, if you're feeling the effects of stress, we can help. Text STRESS to 211-211 to find a solution.
For the news and talk you can't hear anywhere else.
It gives you some awareness of what's really going on.
Where things are at, even around the world.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
On to cocaine. And hell of a way to come right out of a break, isn't it? On to cocaine. Look, famously, and if you weren't involved directly, you might look at what went on in the 1970s and talk about the era of disco. Again, this is the American perspective on it, right? I'm sure the flow and the history, which I wasn't fully prepared to talk about today, but what the hell, let's do it anyway. Fact is that cocaine becomes plentiful. Somehow, post-Vietnam War, once all of the heroin had, you know, dried up a bit, cocaine arrives. Cocaine not only arrives, but it arrives seemingly everywhere. Again, in those cities and stuff, and you know, those crazy places. It was everywhere. It was not all that expensive at the time. I mean, more expensive than the heroin was. I mean, the heroin, there was so much of it. I mean, you know, at a certain point, if you're buying it by the ton and if you're moving it by the ton, I mean, things get cheaper, you know. Even if you buy sugar, it works out that way, doesn't it? Yes, it does. So anyway, cocaine comes in. Now, I got to say, there's a little stretch of time there where maybe some of that history, you got arguments between people who have studied it. And again, academia doesn't even necessarily want to accept the reality of the drug culture and how it drove so many other things that go on within America. I mean, you know, there are some people that do. And we could go back to like the work of John Potesh and people like that and talk about how they hijacked the anti-war movement and created a counterculture specifically to be poisoned by psychedelics and on and on. But that's previous to this cocaine I'm talking about. And of course, cocaine existed, like I said, long before the 70s. But all of a sudden, it filled that void that heroin left behind. And then we get into the Reagan era. And cocaine definitely got a little more expensive, but that's because there were massive amounts being used by people that were making quick, easy money. You know, the age of the junk bond, greed is good. I know I'm doing a lot of sub references to pop culture, a lot of movies today. I don't know why. What are you going to do? That's Wall Street, by the way. Of course, an Oliver Stone film. Interesting guy, Oliver Stone. Sometimes right on point, but always a little crazy. And sometimes I don't know what the hell's in his brain. Anyway, we'll talk about Oliver Stone more when I do a JFK show. And that's coming in the very near future, I assure you. Anyways, back to the drugs. Because this is what happens. The influence is constant. Okay, cocaine. We have the institutions, the development of narco states. And notice, I haven't even gotten to the Mexican situation, the Mexican mafia, the La Familia, all of these guys. No. I'm not going there just yet because they're not the big players just yet. I mean, they definitely saw opportunities. And again, it would have been great to talk to Selly today, but don't worry, we'll get to him in the near future also and talk specifically about what he witnessed personally. And what I've been able to glean about what happened here, where entire countries were basically propped up and assisted by CIA business practices in order to bring the flood of cocaine to America. And as a matter of fact, there was so much of it, and it was so expensive in the powder form that, quite frankly, they couldn't get rid of it fast enough. You know who struck me with that is Freeway Ricky Ross when I interviewed him on the Ocelli Effect a few years ago. And I almost wish I had taped our off-air discussion, because our off-air discussion was him and me commiserating about how the drug game worked in the 1980s and how interesting it was that seemingly simultaneously, instantaneously, in fact, not only was there so much cocaine that they couldn't find enough dealers to move it, but they also, just got passed around, kind of word of mouth, how to create Ready Rock, how to create base, how to create the thing that people would call crack. And this stuff was done on stovetops and in basements of different tenements and things like this all over the country. And, Ricky had so much cocaine, he didn't know how to get rid of it quick enough. He was trying to come up with new ways, innovative ways. Ricky Ross, when he was moving product, trying to figure out how to get rid of it. Freeway Ricky Ross, by the way, not the rapper, but the actual guy. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, if you go online, you can find the interview that I actually did with Freeway Ricky Ross some years ago and Celly Castillo. But again, I digress, so forget it. Back to it. This interesting time period where crack just seemed to pop up everywhere, right? I mean, all praise to the late Mike Rupert, who stepped up and said at a public meeting in Los Angeles, hey, the CIA brought it in here and all this. Oh, and our friend Gary Webb, who mysteriously, not mysteriously, but certainly under odd circumstances, died. You know that guy? If you never heard of him, by the way, if you don't know who Gary Webb was, writing for the San Jose Mercury News, I mean, I urge you to go and Google stuff. And by the way, check my facts and my flow on all of this, please. Please do the research. I'm trying to ask you to do the research, actually, by telling you this story. So I'm only into the very early part of the Reagan era. And later we discover, through the Iran-Contra affair, that there may indeed have been, you know, deals going on here with the military. Ollie North, you know, that Fox News commentator out there that maybe the kiddies don't remember, but I watched. Certainly as this guy started to try and keep his mouth shut in front of Congress. And the interesting episode there with a lady named Fawn Hall and all that good stuff where during the Reagan administration, seems as though former head of the CIA, only for 1 year, by the way, George H.W. Bush, who happened to be vice president at the time, may have indeed also been involved in an operation that had something to do with all this, may have loosed some of the guys out there to work it out so that, you know, weapons could be traded and drugs could be moved and money. And there's a lot of evidence for this, and I urge you go find it. I mean, really, if you think that this is a shocking story I'm telling and that I'm just making things up, by all means, go check it out. But no. No, I'm not making any of it up. Matter of fact, I am giving this a very cursory explanation just to give you an idea what it is that I'm probably going to cover a lot in the very near future because this is important, folks. This is more important than you think, not just because, oh, well, you know, you have sympathy for drug addicts. No. I'm going to tell you how the drug game and the game that the government plays with it, and the game that the CIA plays with it, and the game that the criminal underworld plays with it, whether you know it or not, whether you use drugs or not, whether you think, like I do, that drug prohibition is absolutely counterproductive or not, you cannot deny its effect on seemingly everything around you when you sort out all the details. But anyway, back to cocaine. Still doing well, still doing quite well. And urban chemistry helping it out because Ready Rock, or what they wound up later calling crack was cheap enough and still to this day cheap enough and exists and everything else. You know, you don't think that went away, by the way, just because Percocets are easier to weigh. It doesn't mean that crack doesn't exist. It's still out there, in case you didn't know. But anyway, it was cheaper. It was more accessible. You could move it around easier. All right, there was a way of dealing it a lot easier. So you can move it into, not the most expensive neighborhoods and still make a business out of it. That's on the street level. But of course, the more global thinker there, the guy who is really the businessman, could figure out how to distribute it and run an organization. And it doesn't matter if it is, that's all mafia. Nah, gangbangers got in on it. Bikers got in on it. I assure you that there were housewives selling crack to other housewives to support their crack habits in places that, maybe you wouldn't expect, or maybe you would, depending on how you judge different areas based on their economic standing. But anyway, so crack, running around and doing all that, and then, you know, people went full on with the Nancy Reagan, just say no, crack kills, all that. Yes, indeed. Same time that rock and roll stars were out there, you know, doing PSAs in place of serving their time because, you know, they had drunk driving incidents and so on and so on. In that same time period, later 80s, yeah, we did get a little look at what went on with Iran-Contra, but I assure you the whole story not being revealed. And why did I mention George H.W. Bush in that story? Well, first of all, he was in the White House. It's kind of interesting. And secondly, the guy who I was going to talk to today, I love when he tells this story, by the way. He literally got to meet George H.W. Bush while he was vice president, walked up to him, looked at him and said, you know, some of the people that were supposed to be arresting were actually helping at the time. Selly was a DEA agent working outside of the country. And George H.W. Bush went to go visit the troops. Engaged fully in the drug war, brought to you originally by Richard Nixon, but carried on for generations. Anyway, sorry, I feel like a movie trailer belongs to it. I don't know, movies today, movies on my mind. I'm sorry. I know why the movies are there, but I'm going to get to it in a minute. We saw New Jack City. We saw all of that. Hollywood gave us some of the realism and some of the unrealism that would come along with this. In more recent years, we got to see Kill the Messenger, which did give us the Gary Webb story. rightfully so, calling it Kill the Messenger, because he was the messenger who accidentally discovered that indeed there were CIA assets. I mean, Freeway Ricky Ross, a street-level drug dealer who happened to be smarter than others, he's getting dope from the same people the CIA was. Why? Because he was working with big quantities. Anyways, smart guy. And he doesn't do that now. He's, you know, he did his time and this and that. Look up Freeway Ricky Ross if you don't know what I'm talking about. All right. Anyway, so crack is a thing for a bit. And then because of all the heat and quite honestly, you know, the collapse of the various narco regimes, the need for some reaction, you know, always you got to send out a sacrificial lamb or two, a little bit of regime change, a little bit of action there in Central and South America. You know, following on with the destruction of, say, Allende and all these other individuals previous, you know, the constant manipulation and controlled demolition of the governments, the different regimes, the supporting of death squads. Yeah, all that good stuff going on in El Salvador, Nicaragua, you know, Guatemala. I mean, on and on and on. All these places that wind up bleeding everything from the drugs to the gang members to the people that literally formed, you know, these things they call cartels into Mexico, which is our southern border area. And we all know this too. Anyway, if the U.S. government and its intelligence agencies were not indeed involved in the continuous manipulation, destruction, and tampering with the Central and South American nations and propping up and then simultaneously destroying different narco states, do you think you'd have the circumstance you have today? Open question, really. I don't think so. I think if we stop screwing around down there, we might get somewhere, you know. Anyway, why bring my personal opinion into it? Never mind. So for a little while, because cocaine kind of had to get turned down, the volume anyway, there was a time period in America where the drugs were just a kind of jump ball. You didn't know where it was coming from. It was open season for a little bit. You didn't have a mainline pipe coming in that not only was organized crime feeding into the country, but of course, the Central Intelligence Agency. So something had to be done. A bit of urban chemistry once again, not just, you know, just by spontaneous combustion, having the formula for crack spread all over the country. Because, you know, that's all people were worried about in urban areas where they were actually shoplifting in order to eat and everything else. They were looking for a money stream and trying to figure out how to repurpose cocaine, right? Wrong. Somebody spread that information and had it ready, you know, that knew how to do it. I don't know. Maybe that's part of the history. I don't know. Although I did live on one side of that equation for quite a while. Anyway, crack cocaine, like I said, not as popular, still available, but maybe it was starting to go up in price because of the limited quantity of the resources necessary to continuously package it and create it. Not necessarily create it, but what would we call that? Repurpose the resource. I don't know. I'm trying to be polite. Forget it. Look, it's a cook. So speed had to be better developed because, as I said, there were plenty of people that wanted to stay awake lots. And then the common elements and trying to bring that together, it starts to emerge and become more popular. And the knowledge to create things like crystal meth, well, that starts to fly a little bit, but it's tough. You got to actually, you know how to do that right. Otherwise, first of all, you blow yourself up. And secondly, you got to be real careful with the chemicals. I mean, it's not as easy as getting processed dope from another country and then just taking and whacking it up and spreading it out or repurposing it and stretching your load. I mean, it's just not that easy. You got to actually create this stuff. I mean, I know it's made from common elements. I'm not going to give you the formula here because I don't believe in I don't believe in spreading that information. I know how it's done, but so can you find out anyway. But the thing is, it wasn't working so good. So right on time when the drug business is starting to wane a bit, I mean, you know, everybody's got their weed and whatever, and they can do that. And by the way, I still say cannabis is not a drug. I mean, alcohol did fine, did a fine job for people that wanted to escape or get numb and so on and so forth. But you see, the big pharma companies, they started to come out with a whole slew of, well, opportunistic medicines out there, right? I mean, the use of Prozac rises during this time, this gap between the era of cocaine and the era that I'm about to talk about. In that gap comes a whole lot of pharmaceutical developments that just emerge. A bunch of things that can be abused. I mean, parents started popping their kids Ritalin that they didn't actually need. The parents or the kids, by the way, in my opinion. But supposedly the kids needed some Ritalin in order to calm down. The parents would pop those, and in the right circumstance, with your brain chemistry not being affected a certain way, you got a little bit of accessible speed. Diet pills, over-the-counter crap, all of these things, from Fen-Phen to Stackers, created at this time, pushed, sold, definitely profitable. But see, you couldn't have the underground. You couldn't have the black market so much. I mean, you could resell these things. And, you know, if you didn't have your DEA marked prescription pad version of the pill that belonged to you or whatever, or the thing you could get in liquid form, a bunch of stuff. That gap in the illicit trade wasn't even being adequately filled by the billion-dollar industry that, you know, Big Pharma is, was, and sadly, I think may always be. But anyway, people still wanted drugs. And right around the time that the incidents in New York City and Washington, D.C. and in Pennsylvania occur on September 11, 2001, right around that time, coincidentally, I mean, the first shots fired in Afghanistan happened pretty much right after that. The air raids and all that started right away. But then, of course, the official kickoff and the war on terror really being launched. And all that occurred right there in 2002. And simultaneous and coincidentally, and I would argue causally, what did we get? A whole bunch of new heroin on the world market that we did not see since the 1970s. Quantities, almost unimaginable, available, ready to roll. And somebody tell me it's got nothing to do with the fact that the invasion of Afghanistan happened right then. Somebody tell me that I didn't see news reports about troops guarding opium fields, excuse me, poppy plants. Tell me I didn't see that. Tell me I didn't hear that. Tell me I didn't hear that personally from individuals who went over there and served, despite the fact that they're not conspiracy theorists or looking at this, you know, in any way, shape, or form, like as if they were anti-government or have any sort of view on the drug war that I do. Not at all. But they reported things to me. Unbelievable. Seems like it was a good opportunity. And oh, by the by, not just for the criminal underworld. Because even though your friends at all those pharmaceutical companies, whether they be Johnson & Johnson or Pfizer or Merck or Eli Lilly, et cetera, it doesn't matter whether they were making synthetic opioids or not. They did require some of that real opium base, and they got it. They got it suddenly. And again, coincidentally, those things became readily available, so cheap, being churned out. I mean, statistically, when you look back at some of the numbers where there were towns that, you know, there was like six prescriptions for every man, woman, and child in the town coming out of the local pharmacy. I mean, you would have thought somebody thought something was wrong there. But no. And these guys hired people from the FDA, the DEA, so on and so forth, sometimes so they could literally get them to write reports back to those same agencies to say at a certain point, like when OxyContin was being developed, and OxyContin, again, you know, just another repackaging of opium anyway. When OxyContin was being pushed out there as a reliable mediator of pain and things like that, they turned around and wrote reports that said it is highly unlikely that this would be addictive. Things like this. They hired the people that used to actually, you know, what do? You know, when somebody's your enemy, I mean, if you can buy them off, you do it. And what's the best way to do them? Give them a better job than the job that pays them to chase you. I mean, you know, hire cops to be your security guards. And if you pay them better, they might tell you how to avoid the cops. I mean, it's basic street level stuff. But on a corporate level, which is, you know, force multiplier, certainly an aggregate tool to increase the efficacy of one's actions. Okay. To assist with those actions. Anyway, all these mechanisms. All right. Thing is, so you have opium and then cheap dope again, all over the place. But this time, instead of staying in the cities, instead of staying among the people that nobody gave a crap about anyway, because let's be frank, first of all, they were poor and they weren't, you know, good average Americans. It didn't matter in the 1970s, the 1980s, didn't matter in the 50s, didn't matter in the 40s, the 30s. And oh, don't worry, there was different drug scourges during that time period. Yeah, it didn't matter. Until it did. Funny thing about that. Appalachia being destroyed. Okay, it's hillbilly heroin. That's what they used to call some of these pills and things like that. Hillbilly heroin. It's not hillbilly heroin. It's just an opiate. Just an opiate in another form. It's actually, you know, a more efficient opiate than the heroin that was on the street. And also, you know, some unethical dealers and people might cut things into that heroin that might not be so good. So, you know, you kind of know what you're supposed to be getting from Big Pharma when they at least tell you, look, it's so many milligrams of this, grains of that. And, oh, by the by, it was a good way to sell lots of Tylenol, which is really good for you, too. Except in the case of, like, say, OxyContin, which is just an activator and an opiate. But anyway, forget about the chemical equations. It doesn't matter because you know why? It's all dope, period. And I don't necessarily object to it. Like, morally, I just cannot see how this is. Nah. But we'll get into my personal views in the next segment. The idea that America should have been surprised by this is always a laughable thing to me. The idea that the world, who has had, you know, its issues now, you know, in modern times, we're actually amazed. This stuff has gotten everywhere and it's nothing new to a lot of other spots on the planet, but it's supposedly new to the American people who just didn't want to reckon with the invisible part of America because there are certain people that simply don't count. So it was okay for them to destroy themselves, destroy each other, destroy their neighborhoods. It's okay because, you know, they're savages anyway. Call back to The Godfather once again. I think they said they're animals anyway. Let them lose their souls. Yeah, I think that's what he said. The attitude being voiced by that character in the oddly characterizing pseudo-real mob movie that went on there in the 1970s by Francis Ford Coppola, of course, the script written by Mario Puzo, had a few things to say there regarding the reality, but didn't necessarily package it perfectly, let's say. So back to the reality. We're now confronted with all of this stuff. One way or another. We're now confronted with it directly. People want to talk about it. They use it again as a political football, as they often do. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? What are we going to do? Nobody ever wants to take a look, by the way, at the bottom line. Like, why is it so desirable? why has this done so well? That yes, indeed, it doesn't matter what color you are. It doesn't matter what economic status you have achieved. It doesn't matter. Now it's on everybody. And if we're realistic about all this, forget about heroin, forget about cocaine. How many people are just on drugs constantly who are addicted to something, whether their doctors wrote it for them for their mood, or it's because they're in pain, or it's because they're unhappy, or it's because, well, you know, they've got an issue with their adrenaline, they've got glandular stuff. How many drugs do Americans actually take? I am satisfied to say that we are the most drugged, we are the most ill, we are the most, yes, spoiled, rotten group of individuals on the planet, but we're being drugged and we're being encouraged to embrace every single kind of drug except one problem. The prison industrial complex will be more than happy to sweep you up if you don't take the things that are automatically prescribed and acceptable and taxable and completely monitored by the Drug Enforcement Agency, because the war on drugs is a war on you. But if you take the thing that the government approves of, like I said, you can drink the alcohol, that's fine. Rot out your liver, no problem. Destroy your teeth. Here's some tobacco. Yeah, we're going to act like we're going to push back against that, but that'll kill you too. Any which way you can die, so long as there is a profit to be made off of it, is agreeable to the grand scheme that is arrayed against us regarding this. Again, I'm not making a moral judgment about the drugs themselves. Drugs are not either moral or immoral in my mind. But isn't it immoral if you continuously steer people into requiring a chemical solution to a spiritual problem? If you create a situation where desperation is paramount among the daily lives of individuals, how often do you have to get squeezed before you say, you know what, I want to feel something else outside of desperation. I want to feel something else outside of being trapped. I want to feel something else outside of being used and abused by a system that has done nothing but squeeze me. Oh, man, I'm almost going to go into that personal story again. I guess you'll have to wait for that in the next hour. This is the Chuck Ocelli Show on TNT Radio, and I'm telling you, today's news talk, I don't know if they're ready for the personal story, but stick around. You guys are going to find out.